man, we caught all kinds of fish. She said, really, you caught all kinds of fish? How many did you catch? He said, we caught 100. She said, you caught 100 fish? He said, yes, ma'am, 100 catfish. She said, really? Well, how big were they? He said, they weighed 100 pounds apiece. She said, Johnny, you caught 100 catfish and they weighed 100 pounds apiece? That's 10,000 pounds. How did they fit on your boat? Well, we just piled them up. We got a big boat. She said, Johnny, that is not true. You did not catch 100 catfish that weighed 100 pounds apiece. Are you telling me the truth? He said, yes, ma'am, I'm telling you the truth. She said, that is a lie. What if I told you something like, I'm on my way to school, and I'm driving my little car, and a 10-foot grizzly bear jumps out of the woods and stands in front of my car and is about to attack me, but this little chihuahua runs out of the woods from the other side, grabs him by the nose, flips him over, and chases him back into the woods. Would you believe that? Johnny said, yes, ma'am, I believe that. That's my dog. Well, hopefully we'll be a little more honest than Johnny was in our lesson that we are going to discuss a sticker that was put in the front of the biology textbooks in Cobb County, Georgia. And I want you to listen to it closely. This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory and not a fact regarding the origin of living things. This material should be looked at with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. Now, that's the point of education, isn't it? To look at things with an open mind, to study them carefully, and to critically consider them. Now, you understand what critically consider means. It means to analyze it with the intent of seeing if there's a problem in it. And if there's not a problem with it, then you hang on to the idea. You basically test all things and hold on to what's good and reject what's bad. This shouldn't be a controversial statement. In fact, you should be able to put a sticker like that in the front of every single textbook that anybody uses in any school system anywhere, whether it's talking about evolution, whether it's talking about geography, whether it's talking about the Pythagorean theorem. Study it carefully, critically consider it. If it holds water, hang on to it. If it doesn't hold water, get rid of it. That's what you should be able to do. This sticker was brought before the district court that was there in Cobb County, Georgia, and it was viewed as unconstitutional because supposedly it violated the separation of church and state. Now, let's look at it again. And let's look closely for all statements that hint at religion of any sort. This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory about living organisms. It should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. Can you point to a place that says anything about Jesus on there? Anything about God? Anything about creation, even? How in the world does... I was in Georgia. I was speaking. Several other kids came up to me and said, yeah, that sticker was in our biology textbook. They said they paid kids $15 an hour to rip those stickers out because they were called unconstitutional. And now there are big gaping sticker rip-outs in the front of our biology textbooks where that sticker was but was ripped out. Because supposedly it violates the separation of church and state because it's so very religious, and yet it doesn't say one thing about God, doesn't say one thing about Jesus, doesn't say one thing about the Bible, doesn't say anything about any type of religion whatsoever. Why in the world would you need to rip that statement out of a textbook that teaches on evolution if you're an evolutionist? Well, let's say it happens. Let's say students do start looking at this material with an open mind, studying it carefully and critically considering, looking at it with the intent of finding anything that might be wrong with it so it could be corrected or rejected. What would happen then? Well, what you're going to find out is that if students really were encouraged to look at some of the material in their textbooks that teaches evolution with an open mind and study it carefully and critically consider it, you'd find out exactly what would happen. Now, the first idea that is in virtually every single textbook that you will ever read that suggests evolution is true. Now, let me take one step back and define for you what evolution means. Evolution is the idea that non-living chemicals gave rise to life, and that single-cell original life changed from one kind of life over multiplied millions of years into every kind of life that you see now. Okay, you with me? One kind of life, single cell, changed into, some people say, from goo to you. From a tiny amoeba into what you are now with a genetic makeup of multiplied billions of pieces of information. According to that idea, the English peppered moth supposedly proves evolution. Now here's how this supposedly proves evolution. If you were to look at the English peppered moth in England before the Industrial Revolution, and you were to notice that the light-colored moths on tree trunks are similar to the lichens on the trees, and the dark-colored moths are very obviously different from the tree trunks, and so what do you have here? If you're a bird and you're looking at this tree trunk, which of these do you eat? Well, you obviously eat the dark colored one because it's so much easier to see. And so, if you were to look here at the bottom, this is in the Allen and Bacon General Science book. Now, this is from 1989. Hold on to that idea just for a few minutes until we make a little progress here, and I'm going to show you what's important about that. But this is called an example of evolution in action. It's what they say this is. Because, supposedly, after the Industrial Revolution, you had a change in moth population. You did. As a matter of fact, that's a fact. You had the light colored ratio diminished from 95% to 5%, and the dark colored gained from 5% to 95%. Now, it seems kind of like a technical discussion, but notice what they say. Now, if you're a bird and you see these two moths landed on tree trunks, which one of these do you eat now? Well, now, obviously, you eat the light-colored one because it's so much more visible. And this is an example of nature selecting the most fit organism to live and to prosper and pass its genetic information on. And supposedly, this proves, this idea right here proves that a single-celled amoeba can evolve over multiplied millions of years into a human. It's a piece of evidence for that idea, supposedly. Now, this was from 1989. I've got a couple friends of mine that I'm helping with Lads to Leaders debate. They are seniors in high school. They go to the Rogers High School right outside of Florence, Alabama, where I live. It's right there in Greenhill, Alabama. They were sitting in their biology class, and we're talking about the Lads to Leaders debate proposition, and they say, oh, hey, by the way, just this week, one of my teachers, one of our teachers, was trying to teach us evolution, and what do we do to combat that? And I said, did he use the peppered moths? Their eyes got huge. And they said, yeah, what do you know about the peppered moths? I said, well, let me tell you about the peppered moths. And so I start giving them this explanation. Now, I was invited to do a Devo at their school last Wednesday, and I was standing out in the hall. We were inviting kids in. We had about 85 kids to do the Devo. It's student-led, so you can do it before school there. And the teacher walked by, and they said, that's the teacher that's teaching us evolution. And here is what was said. This was the scenario presented to him. I said, let me ask you a question. I said, did you look closely, critically, at the pictures? They said, no, what are you talking about? I said, look at those. Look at the pictures in your book. Aren't they just conveniently perfect? You ever tried to get a five-year-old to smile for an Easter picture? You know, it's a challenge, let's just say. And if you've got three kids that are 7, 5, and 3, it's even more difficult if you want to get the little chicken that you brought home to be in the picture too, and all the kids to look at the camera at the same time. It's almost impossible. You ever tried to wrangle two English pepper moths and get them to get on a tree trunk perfectly so that you could take a picture of one on a light-colored tree trunk and one on a dark-colored tree trunk? Ever tried that? Well, let me just say I have tried it multiple times. No, I haven't. No, I haven't tried it. You know why? Because English pepper moths don't land on tree trunks. They don't. They've been studying English pepper moths for 50 to 60 years, and they have found two pair that ever have even landed on a tree trunk. They land on the underside of green leaves. Where did they get these pictures? They faked them. They went and caught English pepper moth and glued them on tree trunks or artificially placed them, or they took dead ones and pinned them on there and said, this is proof of evolution. Now, let's say you start getting the kids to critically look at this stuff. You say, okay, guys, this is what supposedly proves evolution. What are some possible problems with that? Oh, number one, the pictures are fake. Okay, could you get us some real pictures? Well, that's going to be problematic because you're going to be taking pictures of these peppered moths underneath green leaves that don't really have anything whatsoever to do with the camouflage of the English pepper moth. Now, something changed the ratio of the pepper moth, but it wasn't, hey, a bird happens to be able to see it better on a lichen-covered or unlichen-covered tree. Oh, and secondly, you know, in order to get an amoeba to go from an amoeba to a human, you've got to add genetic information. What new genetic information was added from the first picture to the second? Did they develop a beak of some sort? Did they grow some new feature that allowed them to get closer to a bird? Is there anything genetically different from the first picture to the second? No. In fact, the first set of pictures there with the light colored and dark colored, you've got the genetic information to have two variations of English pepper moth. What are they? Dark colored and light colored. The second picture, you've got the genetic information available to have two variations of English pepper moth. What are they? Light colored and dark colored. It would be like this. Let's say you had a dog that gave birth to 10 puppies. And this was a black dog that gave birth to 10 puppies. And 8 of them came out dark black. 2 of them came out white. So you've got 8 puppies that are dark black. You've got 2 that are white. Now, this puppy litter is walking across a frozen pond with its mother, and in a tragic puppy accident, a hole in the ice breaks, and 7 of the dark-colored puppies are lost. So now you have 2 white puppies and 1 black puppy. What is that? According to these guys. Evolution in action. That's what that is. Because the ratio of the puppy colors has changed. But what new genetic information do you have? None. And yet this is supposed to be an example of evolution in action. So I said, hey, take that back to your teacher and see what he says. So one of the guys raised his hand. He said, hey, I heard that English pepper moths don't land on tree trunks. He said the teacher started backpedaling and said, well, you know, they're dumb organisms. They'll just land anywhere. That's convenient. They'll just not land anywhere. And yet they've been shown to be on these tree trunks for the last, are you looking at 50 years? This is from a Canadian textbook writer who knew the pictures were fakes. Here's what he said. Well, I mean, you got to look at the audience. How convoluted do you want to make it for a first-time learner? He said, yeah, I know they're fake, but it makes the point real well. I mean, the advantage of this example of natural selection is that it's extremely visual. Let's see how that works. Let's say I've got this new theory that it's groundbreaking. It's amazing. You're not going to believe it, but I've got proof for it. When white cows eat green grass, they grow purple spots. And you say, Kyle, that's ridiculous. We've never seen any white cows with purple spots. I say, no, I can prove it. And so tomorrow, I say, if you guys will show up tomorrow, we've got some green grass. We're going to put these, I got 3 white cows. So we put my 3 white cows out there. They're eating green grass. We go in for our lunch. We come back out, and sure enough, they've all got purple spots on them about the size of a baseball. You think, Kyle, that is amazing. They were just eating green grass, and now they've all got purple spots. One of you, who is very comfortable with cows, walk over, you pet one of the cows, and then you got like an itch on your head. You itch your head. Your wife looks at you, and she says, honey, you got purple all over your head. You say, what? So sure enough, you look, and you got purple all over your head. You get some kind of something to wipe it off, and you think, where am I getting this purple? And then you lose your hand. It's all over your hand. And you think, oh, I just pet that cow. Right? Yeah. So you go over, you take that handkerchief or that paper towel, and you rub it on that cow, and it rubs the purple spot off. And sure enough, it's just paint straight up. And you say, Kyle, you told us that when white cows eat green grass, they grow purple spots. You just tell us, I know. But the advantage of my example is that it's extremely visual. Yeah, but you lied to us. Okay, yes, but you can really see it well. Okay, thank you, Mr. Ritter. Yes, it is extremely visual, but it's fake. It's false. You made it up. And then he says, well, I mean, we want to get across the idea of selective adaptation. Later on, they can look at it more critically. We don't want them to look at it critically now. Let's let them look at it more critically later on. You ever ask yourself when later on would be? What class is it where they say debunking evolutionary evidence that's not really 101? You see that college class as a freshman on any college campus that you've ever been to? When is later on? One of the ironic things about this particular incident was a man who was writing about this was so angry because he had a PhD in the sciences, a terminal degree. Terminal means that's as high as you can go. You can't get any higher than the PhD he had in the sciences. And he said he had never once heard someone explain to him that the English peppered moth material was not evidence for evolution. He was never allowed to critically consider it. You know what the sad part of this is? You know who gets to critically consider this? You know, the proverb says the first person to plead his case seems right until his neighbor comes and answers him. Let's say that the other 25 kids in that biology class in Green Hill, Alabama, don't have somebody like me that they can go talk to. They hear this presented. We might have 30 kids here tonight. This is taught to 30 million kids on a daily basis. So later on is never in most kids' situations. Now, second idea that's presented in virtually every single biology textbook that you will ever see is that life somehow spontaneously arose from non-living chemicals. You see, if you don't have God, then somehow you've got to get life kick-started. Life has to begin somewhere. And so, what we're told is that little singularity blew up, and about 4.5 billion years ago, there was a warm chemical soup on the surface of the Earth. And something like lightning struck that warm chemical soup and created the first building blocks of life, amino acids. And somehow, over blind chance, random processes, those amino acids got together and they formed the first single cell. And you have to get life coming from non-life. And you know, that was an idea that a lot of people believed for many, many years. In fact, hundreds of years, people believed in spontaneous generation. Spontaneous generation, the idea that life can spontaneously, from nothing, pop into existence from non-living chemicals. And so you had people in the 1600s said, yeah, I mean, if you want proof of this, just slap a T-bone steak on the middle of your kitchen counter in the middle of the summer and wait 2 weeks. I wouldn't advise it, but what happens when you slap a T-bone steak on the middle of your kitchen counter and wait 2 weeks when you don't have air conditioning and your windows stay open? Oh yeah, you get maggots. They spontaneously generate from the chemical properties of the air and the meat. And they said, if you don't believe that, if that's not enough evidence for you, take some old sweaty rags, wrap them up in some wheat, and put, wow, first that's ever happened to me right there, a kid shooting out from behind the door by himself. He didn't even miss a beat, man. He got right back up. It's like he spontaneously generated out of water. Where was I? Before the flash shot across the auditorium. Wheat! Wrap it up in some old sweaty rags, put it in the corner of your barn, come back in a month, guess what you'll have? Mice, rats, they spontaneously generate from the chemical properties of wheat and old sweaty rags. That's what was suggested in very intelligent, educated scientific circles. Now, a guy by the name of Francisco Reedy, or Reddy, decided he was going to test the hypothesis. He was going to see if maggots really do spontaneously generate from meat. And so here's what he did. He took some meat, put it in the bottom of a jar, sealed it tight, where nothing could get on it. Hermetically sealed it, airtight, put them over here. Actually, I had several jars. Took some other jars, put meat in the bottom of them, put them over here, left them uncovered. Pretty simple. Flies landed on the uncovered meat, maggots formed, flies tried to get in the meat that was covered, they did not form. He said, you know what I think's happened? Flies. I think that's your maggot problem. They said, no, here's your problem. You didn't let air get into the meat, and that's what causes spontaneous generation. He said, okay. Well, let me see what I can do. So, redoes the experiment, hermetically seals a bunch of jars over here, leaves these open. In the middle, he seals the jars with a netting-like gauze-type substance and puts the meat in the bottom of that. These flies land on the uncovered meat maggots. They try to get in the sealed meat, nothing. They land on the netting. Maggots form on the netting, but not on the meat. He said, there you go. Flies produce maggots. They said, okay, you're right. But does that mean nothing spontaneously generates? He says, no, I still think a bunch of other stuff does, just not maggots. For 200 years. For 200 more years, virtually everyone in the scientific community said life spontaneously generates from non-living chemicals. Until a man by the name of Louis Pasteur came along. Louis Pasteur was commissioned by a winery to find how bacteria was getting into their bottles of wine. They just did not understand it. And so he started looking at the skin of the grape. And on the skin of the grape, the bacteria was on the skin of the grape, and that bacteria was going from the skin of the grape into the wine bottle. And he said, you're getting bacteria from the skin of the grape into the wine bottle. And they said, no, that's not how those little organisms come about. They're just popping to life inside the wine bottle. And he said, no, that's not. Life comes from previously existing life of its own kind. The law of biogenesis. It's the law because every single biological experiment in the history, listen to me, in the history of the world proves that life comes from previously existing life of its own kind in nature. Every one. So he said, all right, once for all, we're going to do away with this idea of spontaneous generation. He, in 1860, I think the experiment went for years and years. He kept it going. He took some meat broth, hay broth, and by 1860 you had microscopes that you could zoom in and see the stuff swimming around. You know, basically people were wondering why you can fix you some chicken soup and not leave it on the counter, but if you leave it on the counter and come back in 2 weeks, you can't eat it again. Okay? You might not be able to see it, but if you could zoom in with a microscope and see what was going on in that chicken soup 2 weeks after it's been sitting on your counter, you would realize there's a lot swimming around there that I can't catch with a rooster tail, and I'm going to leave it in there, right? Okay, so he says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to put meat broth in the bottom of a flask. It's a special S-shaped neck so that air can get in it, because people say you got to have air for spontaneous generation. But we're going to catch all the little microscopic organisms in the little curve of the S-shape. So he boils the meat broth, zooms the microscope in. No organisms. Waits a month, zooms the microscope in, no organisms. Waits a year, zooms the microscope in, no organisms. Breaks the neck off the flask, air goes straight back in. The microscopic organisms are not caught in the little S-shaped curve. Microscopic organisms start swimming around the instant he lets regular air go in. If you drank any milk, you might have seen on the carton of your milk that it is pasteurized. You know what that means? That means that the cows that produce that milk live in a... No, it does not mean they live in a pasture. Pasteurized is a word that came from the name Louis Pasteur, which is a process by which they heat your milk up, flash heat it to 160 degrees for about 30 seconds, and then immediately following that, they hermetically seal it airtight so nothing gets in it. We did some mission work over in Ukraine, and you can take a box of grape juice over with you, and that box of grape juice will last 10 years sealed. It lasts about a week unsealed. Actually, a few days. Why? Because all of the microscopic organisms in that box have been killed by heating it, but once you cut open the side and you let air go in, and the air has those organisms in it, they reproduce. The law of biogenesis. Life comes from previously existing life. Do you know, in order for atheistic evolution to be true, life had to spontaneously generate from non-living chemicals? It's scientifically impossible. It doesn't happen. People have been trying to get life to spontaneously generate from non-living chemicals for hundreds of years, and every single biological experiment ever done shows it's not viable. You cannot do it. Okay, so you've got an idea in textbooks, evolution, that if you look at it critically, the opening statement says life had to spontaneously generate from non-living chemicals. You know the irony of this? When you look at the biology textbooks, they tell you about Reedy, they tell you about Spallanzi, they tell you about Louis Pasteur, and they say they did away with the unscientific idea once and for all of spontaneous generation, and they prove that life comes from previously existing life of its own kind. Sometimes within a paragraph, they then say, but life has to spontaneously generate at some time in the past because we have living things now. Unscientific. Now, the second problem with the idea of atheistic evolution is that not only does it have to suggest life came from non-living chemicals, and that's impossible, but then it has to suggest that that life changed from one kind of life to another kind of life. You've got to get it from an amoeba to a bacteria. You've got to get it from a bacteria to a salamander. You've got to get it from a salamander to a fish, from a fish to a turtle, from a turtle. You've got to get one life changing into a different kind of life. You know, the problem with that is the law by Genesis. Now remember, law is because you've never seen a single exception ever in the history of science. Ever. Now, evolution says not only did life change from one kind to another kind once or twice, or three, but millions of times. Okay. I mean, I hear you. Just show me one example. Well, they can't. Because you and I know the law of biogenesis like we know the law of cause and effect. It's fundamental. We deal with it every day. Let me give you an example. When we were moving from East Tennessee to Middle Tennessee, my dog was about to have babies. And so we put her in the U-Haul, the floorboard, I remember, of the U-Haul. I was little. And we took her, and that night, I mean, she was really about to have babies. And so we put her in the bathtub in the hotel. And the next morning, we were so excited to get up and see if anything had happened. And sure enough, we went into that bathtub, looked in, and there was my dog Max. Maxine, called her Max for short. And there were eight of the most beautiful baby hippopotamuses you've ever seen. They were small, cuddly. Okay, right. If I were then to say, work with me, no, seriously, guys, there were eight baby hippos. Okay, no. You weren't there. You haven't seen every dog in the world give birth. You were not there when my dog gave birth. Why in the world would you not believe my dog gave birth to eight hippopotamuses? Because of the law of biogenesis. It's fundamental. We know it for an absolute positive biological fact. Life comes from previously existing life of its own kind. Now, what if I said, no, of course, it did not. My dog did not give birth to eight hippopotamuses. Here's what really happened. We went in the next morning, looked in the bathtub, and there were eight of the most beautiful half dog, half birds you have ever seen. We call them balls. They were just the cutest thing you've ever seen. They had feathers on the front half. They had fur on the back half with a little feather on the tip of their tail. No? Okay, all right, let me go. Got up the next morning, looked in the bathtub. There were eight of the most beautiful 99% dog, 1% lizards that you have ever seen. We call them dizzards. They just have one little scale right on the top of. You're not buying that either. You know why? Because you know that my dog did not give birth to kittens. You know that my dog did not give birth to half dog, half lizards. You know exactly what my dog gave birth to, and you weren't even there. My dog gave birth to puppies. Because every dog gives birth to puppies. Every cat gives birth to kittens. It's the law of biogenesis. It's the most fundamental biological law in the world. And yet, for evolution to be true, life had to spontaneously generate from non-living chemicals, which we know cannot happen. And then, when that single-celled life arose, it had to change from one kind of life to another kind of life. Millions of times, and there's not a single example of that ever happening, ever in nature? Well, I'll tell you why. There again, we're not validating this because we're quoting Scripture, but the Scripture does validate it. In the beginning, when God starts creating life on day three, the flowers, grass, and the trees, and He tells the flowers and the grass and the trees to be fruitful and multiply after their own kind. And then on day five, He makes the birds and fish, and He tells them to be fruitful and multiply after their own kind. And on day six, when He creates humans and all the land living animals, be fruitful and multiply after your own kind. You know, if evolution were true, you should be able to make new kinds of animals. You can't do that. In fact, the fruit fly is evolutionist's best case scenario for getting a new kind of animal. And here's why. It has a new generation every 14 days. And that new generation every 14 days, you can zap it with every mutagen that you know and mutate its genetic information coming and going. They've been doing this for 100 years. They've been taking poor little fruit flies, been shooting them with radiation, pouring chemicals on them, zapping them with every kind of mutating information that you could possibly mutate. They've gotten these fruit flies to grow wings out where their antennas are supposed to be, to grow legs out of their back, to grow wings out of where their legs are supposed to be. They have mutated fruit flies in every known possible way, and they have the equivalent of what would be millions of years of evolutionary time with a new generation every 14 days. You know what you still got? Fruit flies. They're still recognizably fruit flies. You can't select any new genetic information that is created because no new genetic information is ever created that is useful from mutations. Why? Because the law of biogenesis is a law, and it was set up by God at the very beginning when He brought life into existence and then told that life to multiply after its own kind. Isn't it ironic that you can take a living frog? You know it's got all the parts that you need for life. And you could take that living frog, and if it were to die and all its cells were dead, give that dead carcass to an evolutionary scientist and say, I know all the parts are available to make this frog alive. Just make it live. Just make it live. It's got all the right parts. It's got all the right cells. It's got all the amino acids in the right place. It's got the proteins. They're bent the right way. Just make a dead frog come to life again. And you can't do that, can you? All the parts are there, but there's just something about the germ of life, isn't there? God holds the germ within His hand, we say. And that's a scientific fact. Because you can't get life to spontaneously generate from non-living chemicals. This guy's name is Ernst Haeckel. I said, guys, did they tell you about the similarities in embryos? Their eyes got big again, and they said, yeah, yeah, they did. I said, well, let me explain those to you. In 1880, a guy by the name of Ernst Haeckel read The Origin of Species. It had just been translated into German. And he thought, this is amazing. This is the greatest theory I've ever heard in my whole life. This is going to transform the way everybody thinks about the world. And he said, I'm going to prove it. And so he did. At least he said he did. He said, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Sounds good, doesn't it? Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. And all of his students nodded at the sagacious statement and thought, so true. What in the world does that mean? Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Well, here's what he's saying. The ontogeny of an organism, the way that it grows as it develops from conception to birth, goes through, recaps its evolutionary history, its phylogeny. He said, if you were to zoom in on an embryo at the right time, you would find that, wrong button. I was hoping it was a laser. Okay, what do we got there? Anywhere we can turn it? Oh, there we go. All right. He said, look, zoom in. Now, this is a turtle. This is, I think, a chicken. Here's a pig. Here's a dog. I think it's supposed to be a monkey. That's a monkey, I think. That's a dog. That's supposed to be a human. He said, zoom in right here. you catch them all in a fish stage. If you zoom in another place, you catch them in an amoeba stage. You zoom in just right. If you were to zoom in on the human stage right in between here, about right there, you'd catch it in a monkey stage. Then it recapitulates. It goes through its evolutionary history. The other day, I got an email from a guy. He said, "You guys are idiots." He said, "Y'all need to join the 21st century and quit lying to people about science. You need to take everything else, everything off your website and tell people you've been lying to them. That's unchristian." I said, "Appreciate the feedback." I said, "We'd have to respectfully disagree with your conclusion. But could you give me the one piece of evidence that you feel like is the strongest for proving the idea that evolution is true and that God didn't create the world and didn't create life?" He sent back and he said, yes, I can. He said, "Humans, when they are developing in the embryo stage, have gill slits." Okay. That's what Haeckel said. He said, "See these? These are gill slits that humans, chickens, turtles, they all have. They all go through a fish stage." The guys who were looking at his pictures, though, the other people who studied embryos, they said, "Well, hold on, Haeckel. That just, your pictures don't really look like the embryos we look at. They look very different." They said, "Where did you get those pictures?" He said, "Oh, I drew some from memory." And, he said, "Sometimes I would draw the same embryo and label it three different things. I would draw a pig embryo and label it a dog, pig, and human." They said, "So you just made some of this stuff up?" He said, "Yeah, but it proves the point really well, doesn't it?" I mean, that's basically what he was saying. I'm not quoting him on that, but now, notice that the guy told me that his biggest piece of evidence was that humans have gill slits. Okay, at no point in human development do we ever have gill slits. It was proven in 1880 that what Haeckel was saying was false. It was never correct. He had made it all up. This is Stephen Jay Gould, an evolutionist who is a staunch evolutionist, anti-creationist by all accounts. But he writes an article titled "Atrocious: How Haeckel's Distortions Did Not Help Darwin." He says, "Haeckel remains most famous today as the chief architect and propagandist for a famous argument that science disproved long ago, but that popular culture has never fully abandoned, if only because the standard description sounds so wonderfully arcane and malevolous. Ontogeny, recapitulates phylogeny. Otherwise known as theory of recapitulation, or roughly, the claim that an organism retraces its evolutionary history." What disproved this long ago? Science disproved this long ago, and yet somehow the kids in Greenhill last week were learning that similarities in embryos prove evolution to be the case. No, they don't prove evolution to be the case. Here's what Gould said: "We should therefore not be surprised that Haeckel's drawings enter 19th century textbooks, but we do, I think, have the right to be both astonished and ashamed by a century of mindless recycling." Mindless recycling? Oh yeah, well, if you tell kids they can't critically consider stuff, if you tell them they can't look at it with an open mind, if you tell them, don't study it too carefully, you can do that later. Just listen to what we're telling you, accept it and believe it, don't think through it, and later on you'll be able to think through it somewhere down the road, which is never. So why then do you have a century of mindless recycling of stuff that we've known is false for 120 years? Well, I'll tell you why. You take this stuff out, what do you got left that proves evolution? Nothing. Because evolution didn't happen. You can't prove something that never did occur. I could continue to go through this stuff with you, horse evolution, we've been knowing that's not true, etc. Homology. Let me say this. I have traveled the country for the last 18 years thinking that sometime I'm going to have to change this PowerPoint. I've been using that PowerPoint for 15 years. And I thought, you know, at some point they're going to change the stuff in their books. And I'll need to look at that and I'll need to change it. It hasn't happened yet. They're still using English peppered moss, which we've known for 60 years are false. They're still using similarity in embryos and acting like that proves evolution. They're still saying that life somehow spontaneously generated and then changed into every different kind of life, even though there's not a shred of scientific evidence for that anywhere, and all the evidence points overwhelmingly against it. And now that's why something like this can happen. I've got a book. It's called Truth Be Told. I thought I brought one of them. It's this book right here. It's the book in the middle. Truth Be Told. Where we went through the science textbooks, found all the stuff they're using to teach evolution, refuted it, and put it in our textbook form, Truth Be Told. Right now I've got 7,000 of them sitting on pallets in my office that we're about to ship to Africa. We've got a guy that puts them into schools in Africa. This is his second group of them for 14,000 of them that we've gotten in the school systems in Africa. Not like I said, nonprofit. The guy didn't pay us a dime for them. We covered every bit of the cost from donations and everything, sending them to him. He sent them in banana boxes and shipping them into the schools. So a mother calls us and says, "Hey, Red, Truth Be Told, I want to give one to every one of the kids in my son's first grade class." Now listen to me. You have been told a bunch of garbage about what you can and cannot do with material that has stuff to do with God in it. You can put a book on a table in every school system in the nation and say, if you want that book, you can take it. As long as you don't hand it to them personally. If you passively distribute, meaning put it on a table. I was invited to speak as an author to a little school in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and we had 350 students there. We got congregations to donate the money to give everyone a Truth Be Told. 350 kids came and picked their book up after I spoke for 45 minutes on the existence of God. You can still do that. It's still totally legal. And especially if you do it like this. The mother said, "Well, I want to give 30 of these to one of my kids, my kids' fellow students in his first grade class." Now, we warned her. We said, "Now, it's about a 6th, 7th grade book. First graders might have some trouble reading it." She said, I know what level it is, but I want them to get it. So they'll have it in their hand because it's got everything they're going to need. We said, okay. I think we charged her $3 a piece for them, for 30 of them. So she gets 30 of them, sends them to her kids' school classmates for a Christmas present. Okay? Next year, 2nd grade. They've got a teacher who is avidly pro-evolution. One of the kids who's not associated with the church at all, who happened to be in her son's class the year before, says, "What you're teaching us is not right. This idea of evolution, no, God made the world, God made animals, what you're teaching us isn't correct." She said, "Yes, it is. The book says it is." He said, "Well, I got a book at home that says it's not." She said, "Well, that book's wrong." He said, "Well, that book makes a lot better sense than what you're telling us." Doesn't it? Do you know if you really did critically consider with an open mind and study carefully what's being taught, you know what you'd end up with? Anthony Flew. After he critically considers it, studies it carefully with an open mind, he said, "No, there's a God. I know there is." Because that's where the evidence points. And so let's make sure we're getting that information to the people that need it most. Thank you very much for being here. Let me conclude by giving you just a couple of resources. This book right here is one of our newest. It's called Reasons to Believe. In 98 pages, we have basically summarized the most popular arguments for the existence of God, the inspiration of the Bible, and the deity of Christ. If you have a friend who reads on a 7th grade level or better that would take an hour or two to read something that is just the most basic, hey, here's how you can know there's a God, this book is what he would need, what she would need. We charge $4 for it. But we have shipped out boxes and boxes where we have, somebody says, "Well, I need 300 of those to pass out at a fair." Okay, we'll give them to you for $2. "Well, I don't have $2 a piece. I only got $300. Okay, we'll give them to you for $1. If you need bulk of anything we got, Lots of people pass them out at fairs. They send them over to different countries when they do mission work, etc. Just let us know. We'll ship them. All right. Does God Exist? Brand new book came out a month ago. The Basic Arguments for the Existence of God. This is kind of a summary of what we did in our first lesson this evening. The idea of design demanding a designer, several arguments for the first cause, etc. That's what that is. Now, let me tell you what a guy down in Muscle Shoals, right outside of Muscle Shoals, he said, our church wants to put one of your hardback full-color books in every school classroom in our county. He said, so these five books, what can you give them to us for? So he had a big bulk order, and we charged him $25 for the five of them. And he collected enough to, I think he put in 125 sets, or 80, it might have been 80 sets. I don't remember exactly how many sets, of all five of these kids' books in the classrooms that were in the age level, like third through sixth grade classrooms in the county in that school. So basically, they went to the teachers and said, hey, do you want these books? And the teacher said, yeah, we'll take them. And so they put them on their bookshelves so that the students, when they have free time or whatever, can come and get them and read them, etc. Several people said, hey, we could do that to the local library. And so they got this pack of five books to put in their local library, etc. Now, we've got 180 people here, 160. I feel like we've had a productive evening. I feel like we've really got a lot of good stuff done. I feel like your faith has been strengthened. You have been blessed by being here. I've been blessed by you being here. But now let's ask this question. Who needs this material the most? Well, our young people do who are here, and lots of the young people who are not here. And so our question is, how can you get this information to the people who need it most? We see people doing it in all kinds of different ways. Had a guy last night. There's a street fair in Florence, Alabama that happens on the first Friday of every month. He came to us. He said, could you give me materials to pass out at the street fair first Friday of every month? We were able to give him all kinds of materials to do that. He's been doing that for about 5 years. First Friday of every month in the pretty months, March, April, May, June, July, all the way through to about August, he passes out material to people that come through. We've got the Illinois State Fair. 100,000 people come through the Illinois State Fair. Guys, the congregations up in Illinois have said, hey, what's the cheapest you can get material to us? We're going to pass out. They pass out some 10,000 people come to their booth at the Illinois State Fair. They pass out thousands and thousands of dollars worth of material that we ship them. So here's what I'm asking. You don't have to buy it. Send them to the website. Get them a free downloadable ebook. Show them a video on YouTube. All the stuff's on YouTube. But somehow, get this information to the people who need it the most. You got a niece, nephew, great niece, great nephew, grandson, granddaughter, child, friend of your child. When can they look at it more critically? Lots of times, it's if somebody like you goes out of their way at your expense and time to say, I'm going to give my grandson's class every one of those. I'm going to get one of those books for every one of my grandkids' class. And that second grader is emboldened to say to his teacher, no, what this book, they're talking about God, makes a lot better sense than what you're telling us. But if he didn't have that book, well, we'll look at what happens Sunday morning when they don't have that type of information. Sure appreciate you being here tonight. I'd like to thank the men of this congregation, the women of this congregation, for the preparation that you have done. Let me tell you something. This kind of attendance does not happen by accident. It is obvious that there has been lots of good work put into this event. There have been prayers that have been said. There have been expenses that have been put out to advertise, to get me here, to get you here. And personally, I am thrilled with your attendance tonight. Thank you so much for letting me be a part of your weekend, this weekend. And thank the men and the women of this congregation for making this possible for all of us. Really appreciate it.